The Doctrine of Fascism by Benito Mussolini. Like all sound political conceptions, fascism is action and it is thought. Action in which doctrine is immanent, and doctrine arising from a given system of historical forces in which it is inserted, and working on them from within. It has, therefore, a form correlated to contingencies of time and space, but it has also an ideal content which makes it an expression of truth in the higher region of the history of thought. There is no way of exercising a spiritual influence in the world as a human will dominating the will of others, unless one has a conception both of the transient and the specific reality on which that action is to be exercised, and of the permanent and universal reality in which the transient dwells and has its being. To know men, one must know man, and to know man, one must be acquainted with reality and its laws. There can be no conception of the state which is not fundamentally a conception of life, philosophy or intuition, system of ideas evolving within the framework of logic, or concentrated in a vision or a faith, but always, at least potentially, an organic conception of the world. Thus, many of the practical expressions of fascism, such as party organisation, system of education, and discipline, can only be understood when considered in relation to its general attitude towards life, a spiritual attitude. Fascism sees in the world not only those superficial material aspects in which man appears as an individual, standing by himself, self-centred, subject to natural law, which instinctively urges him towards a life of selfish momentary pleasure. It sees not only the individual, but the nation and the country, individuals and generations bound together by a moral law, with common traditions and a mission which, suppressing the instinct for life, closed in a brief circle of pleasure, built up a higher life founded on duty, a life free from the limitations of time and space, in which the individual, by self-sacrifice, the renunciation of self-interest, and by death itself, can achieve that purely spiritual existence in which his value as a man consists. The conception is therefore a spiritual one, arising from the general reaction of the century against the materialistic positivism of the 19th century. Anti-positivistic, but positive, neither sceptical nor agnostic, neither pessimistic nor supinely optimistic, as are, generally speaking, the doctrines, all negative, which place the centre of life outside man, whereas by the exercise of his free will, man can and must create his own world. Fascism wants man to be active and to engage in action with all his energies. It wants him to be manfully aware of the difficulties besetting him and ready to face them. It conceives of life as a struggle in which it behooves a man to win for himself a really worthy place, first of all by fitting himself physically, morally, intellectually, to become the implement required for winning it. As for the individual, so for the nation, and so for mankind. Hence the high value of culture in all its forms, artistic, religious, and scientific, and the outstanding importance of education. Hence also the essential value of work, by which man subjugates nature and creates the human world, the economic, political, ethical, and intellectual. This positive conception of life is obviously an ethical one. It invests the whole field of reality as well as the human activities which master it. No action is exempt from moral judgment. No activity can be despoiled of the value which a moral purpose confers on all things. Therefore, life, as conceived of by the fascist, is serious, austere, and religious. All its manifestations are poised in a world sustained by moral forces and subject to spiritual responsibilities. the fascist disdains an easy life. Those who perceive nothing beyond opportunistic considerations in the religious policy of the fascist regime fail to realise that fascism is not only a system of government, but also, and above all, a system of thought. In the fascist conception of history, man is man only by virtue of the spiritual process to which he contributes as a member of the family, the social group, and the nation, and in function of history, to which all nations bring their contribution. Hence the great value of tradition in records, in language, in customs, and in the rules of social life. Outside history, man is a non-entity. Fascism is therefore opposed to all individualistic abstractions based on 18th century materialism, and it is opposed to all Jacobinistic utopias and innovations. It does not believe in the possibility of happiness on earth as conceived by the economistic literature of the 18th century, and it therefore rejects the theological notion that at some future time the human family will secure a final settlement of all its difficulties. This notion runs counter to experience, which teaches that life is in continual flux and in process of evolution. In politics, fascism aims at realism. In practice, it desires to deal only with those problems which are the spontaneous product of historic conditions and which find or suggest their own solutions. Only by entering into the process of reality and taking possession of the forces at work within it can man act on man and on nature. Anti-individualistic, the fascist conception of life stresses the importance of the state and accepts the individual only insofar as his interests coincide with those of the state, which stands for the conscience and the universal will of man as a historic entity. It is opposed to classical liberalism, which arose as a reaction to absolutism and exhausted its historical function when the state became the expression of the conscience and will of the people. Liberalism denied the state in the name of the individual. Fascism reasserts the rights of the state as expressing the real essence of the individual, and if liberty is to be the attribute of living men and not of abstract dummies invented by individualistic liberalism, then fascism stands for liberty, and for the only liberty worth having, the liberty of the state and of the individual within the state. The fascist conception of the state is all-embracing. Outside of it, no human or spiritual values can exist, much less have value. Thus understood, fascism is totalitarian, and the fascist state, a synthesis and a unit inclusive of all values, interprets, develops, and potentates the whole life of a people. No individuals or groups, political parties, cultural associations, economic unions, or social classes can be outside the state. Fascism is therefore opposed to socialism, to which unity within the state, which amalgamates classes into a single economic and ethical reality, is unknown, and which sees in history nothing but the class struggle. Fascism is likewise opposed to trade unionism as a class weapon, but when brought within the orbit of the state, fascism recognises the real needs which gave rise to socialism and trade unionism, giving them due weight in the guild or cooperative system in which divergent interests are coordinated and harmonised in the unity of the state. Grouped according to their several interests, individuals form classes. They form trade unions when organized according to their several economic activities. But first and foremost, they form the state, which is no mere matter of numbers, the sums of the individuals forming the majority. Fascism is therefore opposed to that form of democracy which equates a nation to the majority, lowering it to the level of the largest number. But it is the purest form of democracy, if the nation be considered as it should be, from the point of view of quality rather than quantity, as an idea, the mightiest because the most ethical, the most coherent, the truest, expressing itself in a people as the conscience and will of the few, if not, indeed, of one, and ending to express itself in the conscience and the will of the mass, of the whole group, ethnically moulded by natural and historical conditions, into a nation, advancing as one conscience and one will along the same line of development and spiritual formation. Not a race, nor a geographically defined region, but a people, historically perpetuating itself, a multitude unified by an idea and imbued with the will to live, the will to power, self-consciousness and personality. Insofar as it is embodied in a state, this higher personality becomes a nation. It is not the nation which generates the state. That is an antiquated naturalistic concept which afforded a basis for 19th century publicity in favour of national governments. Rather, it is the state which creates the nation, conferring volition and therefore real life on a people made aware of their moral unity. The right to national independence does not arise from any merely literary and idealistic forms of self-consciousness, still less from a more or less passive and unconscious de facto situation, but from an active, self-conscious political will expressing itself in action and ready to prove its rights. It arises, in short, from the existence, at least in theory, of a state. Indeed, it is the state which, as the expression of a universal ethical will, creates the right to national independence. A nation, as expressed in the state, is a living ethical entity only insofar as it is active. Inactivity is death. Therefore, the state is not only authority which governs and confers legal form and spiritual value on individual wills, but it is also power, which makes its will felt and respected beyond its own frontiers, thus affording practical proof of the universal character of the decisions necessary to ensure its development. This implies organisation and expansion, potential if not actual. Thus the state equates itself to the will of man, whose development cannot be checked by obstacles, and which, by achieving self-expression, demonstrates its infinity. The fascist state, as a higher and more powerful expression of personality, is a force, but a spiritual one. It sums up all the manifestations of the moral and intellectual life of man. Its functions cannot, therefore, be limited to those of enforcing order and keeping the peace, as the liberal doctrine had it. It is no mere mechanical device for defining the sphere within which the individual man may duly exercise his supposed rights. The fascist state is an inwardly accepted standard and rule of conduct, a discipline of the whole person. It permeates the will no less than the intellect. It stands for a principle which becomes a central motive of man as a member of civilized society, sinking deep down into his personality. It dwells in the heart of the man of action and of the thinker, of the artist and of the man of science, the soul of the soul. Fascism, in short, is not only a lawgiver and a founder of institutions, but an educator and a promoter of spiritual life. It aims at refashioning not only the forms of life, but their content, man, his character, and his faith. To achieve this proposal, it enforces discipline and uses authority, entering into the soul and ruling with undisputed sway. Therefore, it has chosen as its emblem the lictor's rods, the symbol of unity, strength, and justice. When in the now distant March of 1919, speaking through the columns of the Popolo d'Italia, I summoned to Milan the surviving interventionists who had intervened and who had followed me ever since the foundations of the Fasci of Revolutionary Action in January 1915. I had in mind no specific doctrinal programme. The only doctrine of which I had practical experience was that of socialism, from until the winter of 1914, nearly a decade. My experience was that both of a follower and a leader, but it was not doctrinal experience. My doctrine during that period had been the doctrine of action. A uniform, universally accepted doctrine of socialism had not existed since 1905, when the revisionist movement, headed by Bernstein, arose in Germany, countered by the formation in the seesaw of tendencies of a left revolutionary movement which in Italy never quitted the field of phrases, whereas in the case of Russian socialism, it became the prelude to Bolshevism. Reformism, revolutionism, centrism, the very echo of that terminology is dead. While in the great river of fascism, one can trace currents which had their source in Sorel, Pegui, Legardel of the movement socialists, and in the cohort of Italian syndicalists who from 1904 to 1914 brought a new note into the Italian socialist environment, previously emasculated and chloroformed by fornicating with Giolitti's party, a note sounded in Olivetti's Pagine Libere, Orano's Lupa, Enrico Leoni's Devenir Sociales. When the war ended in 1919, socialism, as a doctrine, was already dead. It continued to exist only as a grudge, especially in Italy, where its only chance lay in inciting to reprisals against the men who had willed the war and who were to be made to pay for it. The Popolo d'Italia described itself in its subtitle as the daily organ of fighters and producers. The word producer was already the expression of a mental trend. Fascism was not the nursling of a doctrine previously drafted at a desk. It was born of the need of action, and was action. It was not a party, but, in the first 2 years, an anti-party and a movement. The name I gave the organisation fixed its character. Yet if anyone cares to reread the now crumpled sheets of those days, giving an account of the meeting at which the Italian Fasci di Combattimento were founded, he will find not a doctrine, but a series of pointers, forecasts, hints, which, when freed from the inevitable matrix of contingencies, were to develop in a few years' time into a series of doctrinal positions, entitling fascism to rank as a political doctrine differing from all others past or present. If the bourgeoisie, I then said, believe that they have found in us their lightning conductors, they are mistaken. We must go towards the people. We wish the working classes to accustom themselves to the responsibilities of management so that they may realise that it is no easy matter to run a business. We will fight both technical and spiritual rearguardism. Now that the succession of the regime is open, we must not be faint-hearted. We must rush forward. If the present regime is to be superseded, we must take its place. The right of succession is ours, for we urged the country to enter the war, and we led it to victory. The existing forms of political representations cannot satisfy us. We want direct representation of the several interests. It may be objected that this programme implies a return to the guilds or corporations. No matter. I therefore hope this assembly will accept the economic claims advanced by national syndicalism. Is it not strange that from the very first day at Piazza San Sepolcro, the word guild or corporazione was pronounced, a word which, as the revolution developed, was to express one of the basic legislative and social creations of the regime? The years preceding the March on Rome cover a period during which the need of action forbade delay and careful doctrinal elaborations. Fighting was going on in the towns and villages. There were discussions, but there was something more sacred and more important. Death. Fascists knew how to die. A doctrine fully elaborated, divided up into chapters and paragraphs with annotations, may have been lacking, but it was replaced by something far more decisive, by a faith. All the same, if with the help of books, articles, resolutions passed at congresses, major and minor speeches, anyone should care to revive the memory of those days, he will find, provided he knows how to seek and select, that the doctrinal foundations were laid while the battle was still raging. Indeed, it was during those years that fascist thought armed, refined itself, and proceeded ahead with its organisation. The problems of the individual and the state, the problems of authority and liberty, political, social, and more especially national problems, were discussed. The conflict with liberal, democratic, socialistic, Masonic doctrines, and with those of the Partito Popolare, was carried on at the same time as the punitive expeditions. Nevertheless, the lack of a formal system was used by disingenuous adversaries as an argument for proclaiming fascism incapable of elaborating a doctrine at the very time when that doctrine was being formulated. No matter how tumultuously, first, as is the case with all new ideas, in the guise of violent, dogmatic negations, then, in the more positive guise of constructive theories, subsequently incorporated in 1926, 1927 and 1928 in the laws and the institutions of the regime. Fascism is now clearly defined not only as a regime, but as a doctrine. This means that fascism, exercising its critical faculties on itself and on others, has studied from its own special standpoint and judged by its own standards all the problems affecting the material and intellectual interests now causing such grave anxiety to the nations of the world, and it is ready to deal with them by its own policies.